I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Today our guest is Craig Yerke. He's the Idaho State Director of the Wilderness Society, a group that promotes wilderness designations and forest restoration in Idaho. We'll get into what that designation means and how you can enjoy these public wild places. Peter, Idaho has a lot of public lands, and 14% of those are designated wilderness areas.
The best part about Idaho is the public lands and the wilderness spaces. You know, growing up in the Midwest and Iowa, not a lot of public lands for us to use. Small parks, of course, but the sheer amount of wilderness in Idaho is staggering.
It's a blessing that we have, and the fact that people are thinking ahead for future generations to preserve, you know, the natural beauty of these places, the natural ecosystems and how they function is really important. And so wilderness designations are a key tool to preserving that for future generations. And so we'll get into that today. But before we get there, we've got a little nature news.
We've got some nature news, Leif. Question: what lays eggs, has zero teeth, venomous spurs, sweats milk, and has 10 sex chromosomes?
Well, you had me with, I was thinking chicken.
Right.
Until you got to the poisonous part. And I don't think chickens are there. So
it is a platypus.
It's a platypus.
A duck-billed platypus.
A duck-billed platypus.
So researchers led by the University of Copenhagen have been wondering why the platypus is such a strange critter. And so they started mapping the genome, and they found some really kind of cool answers. The platypus belongs to the mammalia class, but it has bird and reptilian features. It lays eggs, but it also has mammary glands, which, of course, is used to feed the offspring. And what they found out is within chickens, birds, they have three vitelliginin genes, which result in eggs.
Okay.
A platypus has one. So it still produces eggs, but it doesn't rely or doesn't need to produce the yolk within that egg as the food source. So mammals have casein genes, which produce the casein protein, which is part of our milk. Platypus have this gene as well. So that means they produce milk just kind of like a cow, except they sweat it out instead of actually having a teat to direct it, which is kind of crazy when you think about it as well. And then when you look at the no teeth, most mammalian species have teeth. Well, about 120 million years ago, platypus lost 4 of the 8 genes for teeth. And now, no teeth, just that big bill to smash their food. And then the final crazy bit about it is they have 10 sex chromosomes. 5 X's and 5 Y's, as opposed to one of each. And we're not sure why, but this is way more common with chicken instead of humans. So we really are looking at the evolutionary link between birds and mammals.
Well, it's a real mosaic of traits,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
That are crisscrossing between these, what you think of well-established groups.
Right, right.
Of what a bird is and what a mammal is or a reptile is. And I think recently we've discovered that platypuses glow under UV light.
Yes, they do. You know, we didn't even get into the venomous spurs or their ability to fluorescent. You know, scorpions glow under UV light
that,
as well.
That is a favorite thing to do in the desert, go out at night with a black light and wow.
There they are.
There they are.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's crazy. Australia is insane. It's, of course, a gigantic, huge island. And you look at the oceans around them, and there's a Wallace line that's north that really prevented these high-powered predators to come off of Asia into Australia. And so there was no competition. There was no heavy competition with the rest of the animals. And you see the marsupials and of course, the duck-billed platypus. It really is kind of a neat opportunity to start making those connections between our evolutionary chains.
That's great. Isn't nature wonderful?
Nature is insanely wonderful.
Worth protecting beasts like that.
That's yes.
Pretty cool. Well, today we're going to talk about preservation from a different vantage point in terms of wilderness areas. And today's trivia question deals exactly with that in Idaho. So how many acres of wilderness area are classified in Idaho, and how does this compare to other states in the United States? We'll get to that right after the break with our guest, Craig Yerke.
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org, or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Welcome back. I want to welcome our guest today, Craig Yerke. He's the Idaho State Director of the Wilderness Society based out of Boise. Thank you for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
Well, so now you are the Idaho State Director for the Wilderness Society. I want you to tell us about the Wilderness Society, but first, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Well, I'm an Idaho native. My family homesteaded in Idaho back in 1895, up in the northern part of the state. And my wife's a native also. We raised our kids here, so we have a pretty long history in the state. I graduated from the University of Idaho, started out working for the Forest Service back in the late 70s, and that didn't last very long, as it turns out. Different philosophies for land, and then kind of gravitated toward the more activist role, I guess, working for nonprofits that were conservation-oriented. And ended up at the Wilderness Society, and this year's my 36th year working for the Wilderness Society.
I do have to say, Craig, you are by far the gold standard for guests on The Nature of Idaho. Idaho is you.
Well, now tell us about the Wilderness Society and what its mission is.
Okay. Well, the Wilderness Society was formed back in 1935, and was formed by seven individuals who even got together because even back then they saw what they perceived to be the loss of wild country. They saw more and more roads being punched into backcountry areas, both in the West and on the East. And they thought there was the need for an organization to stand up for the protection of wildness, for the protection of this sense of solitude, for places that are free from motors. And they formed the Wilderness Society, so on. The Wilderness Society is based in Washington, D.C., and we have field offices around the United States. We have one here in Boise, we have one up in Bozeman, Montana, one in Denver, Colorado, and so on throughout the West and in the East. And our focus is the, you know, protection of wild areas, designation of some of those areas as official wilderness areas. And we also work on public land management policies. And by public land, obviously, we mean the land managed by the U.S. Forest Service, land managed by the Bureau of Land Management. Policies being to protect, you know, wildlife habitat, to protect clean water, to protect basically those tracts of land that are in good ecological condition, and to advocate for policies that maintain that.
Craig, before we go forward, what is kind of like the definition of a wilderness area? And then how does an area get designated as such?
A wilderness area is a very specific designation. It takes an act of Congress to do it. All the areas we have in Idaho were all evaluated usually by months, if not years, of debate in Congress. And it's an official act passed by both houses and signed by the president. And the goal of wilderness is basically to identify those tracts of land that are, as the Wilderness Act says, untrammeled. It doesn't have to be pristine, it's untrammeled, which means man's impact is substantially unnoticed. So you can have, you know, fire lookouts, you can have old mining cabins, you can have, you know, trails, obviously. The idea is to find those tracts of land and say, this area shall be managed to protect that wild character that it currently has.
And so within a wilderness area, what typical activities can and cannot occur in those tracts of land?
The Wilderness Act itself, so the Wilderness Act that's kind of set up this framework for management was passed in 1964. And it laid out a lot of the expectations for these areas that still exist today. For example, you can graze livestock in a wilderness area. You can obviously build trails. You can push come to shove. You can control a fire. And this happens every single year. In Idaho's wilderness areas, the managers take actions to control fires. You can hike, you can hunt, you can fish, you can pick berries, you can basically certainly camp. So a lot of what's What's not allowed in the wilderness, though, is the use of motors. Like, you can't ride a motorcycle in there. You can't take a trail bike in there. Or you can't take a mountain bike in there, because a mountain bike is considered to be a mechanized use, and that's not allowed under the Wilderness Act. Now, Idaho can be kind of special because in our one of our wilderness areas, the River of No Return Wilderness Area, had airstrips constructed in it before it was designated, and those were allowed to remain. So if you have some pre-existing uses that aren't quite wilderness-like, if you will, a lot of times those will be allowed to continue after an area is designated as wilderness.
So I'm not going to ask how many acres, because you're going to tell this at the end, but how many designated wilderness areas are in Idaho?
We actually have 15 designated wilderness areas. And that's a lot more than people realize, because a lot of times when they tend to group the wilderness areas down in Owyhee County into one area. And that's actually not true. There are actually several areas designated then. And the same with the Bold White Clouds when that was designated not too long ago. Those are three separate wilderness areas. So we actually have 15 designated wilderness areas within the state of Idaho.
When wilderness areas were being decided upon in the state, is there an attempt to try to capture regions that have a diversity of wild spaces as opposed to all of the same type located in particular geographic locations?
That's a good question. And you know, actually, in reality, most of Idaho's wilderness areas came about because there were groups, association with Idahoans who simply loved the place and wanted to see it left alone. The diversity of the wilderness system is a goal that, you know, conservationists like myself share. But basically down the line, a place was designated wilderness because Idahoans, a group of Idahoans got together and say, we don't want to see this place changed. Perfect example is that of the White Clouds. You know, the White Cloud effort was kicked off in the late 1960s in response to the proposed open pit mine. And Idahoans didn't want to see that mine occur in the White Clouds. And they saw that, you know, the one way to protect that permanently was to put it within a wilderness area so that the mining company couldn't put in this large open pit mine that they had foreseen besides Castle Peak. Same with Hell's Canyon. You know, the Hell's Canyon area was slated for extensive hydroelectric dam construction back in the 50s and the 60s. And certainly some of them got constructed, but at one point, folks who knew, you know, the lower stretch of the canyon and knew how spectacular it was, said this place should remain undammed. Protected the way it is as a wild canyon. And they got together and was able to kind of stem the tide of dam building that was marching its way down the Snake River at the time. And that's the same story with the Middle Fork of the Salmon River, which is within the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness. Again, folks, Idahoans wanted to see the Middle Fork watershed protected from dredge mining, from any kind of dam building, any kind of proposals to build roads in there. And so they got together and said, let's protect the Middle Fork of the Salmon River as a wilderness area.
So with our 15 wilderness areas, one of the things that, you know, I'm always kind of fascinated with and research and look into is these wildlife corridors in connectiveness. Are some of these areas connected to each other? So we get some, you know, general flow of wildlife and activity, or are they more isolated, patchy areas within Idaho?
A couple of things to that. We can talk about kind of wildlife connectivity a little bit later, because that's one of the things that that the Wilderness Society is very interested in fostering in Idaho and across the country now. For Idaho, we're actually quite fortunate, because from the Sawtooth White Clouds all the way north through the Frank Church to the Gospel Hump to the Selway Bitterroot, you have millions of acres of wild country north to south through the middle part of the state, which you have, you know, certainly you have elk, you have wolves, you have wolverines, you have, you know, mountain lions, a whole host of wildlife species in that big chunk of wild country in the central part of the state that can go back and forth from the northern part to the southern part, depending on their, you know, individual needs and their habits. That was kind of by accident, as it turns out, because a lot of times wilderness areas were designated to protect, you know, a recreational potential or maybe one species. as it turns out, there's a whole bunch of benefits from wilderness areas that we're just finding out now as you learn more about, oh, here's a bighorn sheep population that not only goes up and down the main Salmon River Canyon, but jumps the divide and goes to Hell's Canyon once in a while too. You know, we didn't know that until, I don't know, maybe 25 years ago.
So tell us about recent activities in Idaho and efforts that where you were able to have some successes in developing wilderness areas.
Jumping back to the early 2000s, you know, Idaho's last, the Frank Church of North Turn Wilderness Area was designated in 1980. And that was the last wilderness designation in Idaho for almost 30 years. So we had a big dry spell, if you will. The politics were not conducive to wilderness designation for, you know, almost three decades. The Owyhee Canyon lands wilderness areas were designated, and that kind of stopped the drought. And that was an approach we took many years of collaboration with local ranchers, with the county commissioners, with local elected officials, conservationists and outfitters and river runners to kind of come up with an, you know, area by area recommendation for, you know, Canada wilderness areas down in Owyhee County. And that collaborative approach kind of broke the deadlock, if you will. Again, it was folks who had been running the rivers for many years who knew how special the canyon lands were. But it also involved, you know, the ranchers whose day-to-day lives were down there in those areas running their livestock. It took a while to get there because it was a collaboration at that level was pretty rare. But we were successful and we got a wilderness bill passed. At the same time that was happening, you know, Congressman Simpson was taking more of a leadership role in the Boulder White Clouds. And that also was a collaborative effort to kind of come together with the idea of let's finally settle the fate of the Boulder White Clouds, what's going to be wilderness and what's not. And that bill passed about 5 years after the Owyhees were done. So both of those, the most recent two wilderness designations in Idaho, came about through a lot of collaboration with local folks and trying to kind of hit that sweet spot where people felt like, you know, this was very much a ground up effort, also with an eye of what could actually get through Congress.
It sounds like there needs to be a good call for why the area needs to see protection. But as you say, there's a lot of entities that are involved collaborating and compromising and finding maybe a common mutual purpose. And then you have to have this persistence because, you know, this doesn't happen overnight or in a day or in a year or 2 years. You know, this is many years of effort collaboratively to make something happen. It has to go through Congress and so forth, as you said. And so doesn't it really require institutions, like beyond individuals, but institutions to ride through this process, which is a many-year persistent process?
It does. I mean, the consistency of, like you say, the institutions, the entities committed to it. But then also, as it turned out, there's very much a relationship between individuals. I think it's important too, because you have to build trust of folks to be able to deliver a constituency and be able to kind of like, you know, I understand where a rancher's coming from and is concerned about wilderness. They understood what I wanted to accomplish if I wanted to protect, say, bighorn sheep habitat. Once we understood what our goals were, sometimes they overlapped, sometimes they didn't, but they also weren't 100% mutually exclusive either. After individuals got to know each other and got dialogue. And I also can't stress enough the importance of getting out on the ground and just looking at stuff, because it's very easy to kind of have this abstract discussion over maps, but you never get anywhere. You go out and walk to the rim of a canyon and talk about where a wilderness boundary might be and why it should be wilderness. You can kind of clear away all the clutter of the philosophical opposition and the philosophical support and kind of really get down to say, okay, how is this going to work on the ground?
So once you've got the area designated, I'm making the assumption that you just don't go, yep, we did it, and you walk away. What happens after you've designated the area?
There's still a lot of work to do because each, you know, just in terms of, you know, geeking out at a federal level, each wilderness area requires a very in-depth management plan to be developed. And the goal of the plan is to protect the wild character of the area. But a lot of decisions get made. What trails, what level of trail maintenance do you shoot for? What kind of river, what number of river permits do you issue? If you're flowing river like the Middle Fork or like the Bruno Jarbidge, how do you deal with, like, say, livestock grazing? If somebody needs to use a pickup to go drop off salt for his livestock. Can he do that occasionally within a wilderness area? How do you maintain a fence there? There's lots of different questions. And actually, kind of as a side note, after the Owyhees were designated, we actually had to go back and pass another piece of legislation several years later to adjust the boundaries, because we actually got them wrong in a couple places with the first bill. At a scale of half a million acres, you're gonna make a mistake here. And that, it's funny because it took us two or three runs to get that legislation through Congress. You'd think it'd be pretty simple. Well, it wasn't, because wilderness issues never are, but there were just places where we'd made a mistake and we thought, oh, this was not supposed to be wilderness, or this little boundary edge was supposed to be over here a mile to the west or east or whatever. And it was important to go back and fix that because we'd all committed to a certain package.
You led into this a little bit before in our discussion, but what's the future needs and direction that the Wilderness Society is pointing to in Idaho?
One thing that we've spent a lot of time on right now is looking at this idea of landscape connectivity for wildlife. And the reason we're looking at that is quite obvious. Climate change is going to drive a lot of the natural resource decisions, I think, in the near future. And what's Idaho going to look like 20, 30 years from now? And particularly, what's that's going to mean for us wildlife populations? We've already seen, our fire seasons are a month earlier and a month later. As climates change, what does that mean for when elk move to their winter range? What does that mean for when bighorn sheep come down and to the places where they winter? And how are they going to get there? What season are they going to use their winter range? Are they going to use it earlier or later? Wildlife species are incredibly adaptive if they have room to maneuver, room to move and find new habitats at certain times of the year. So a lot of our work is trying to keep places, like basically identify existing migration corridors and see what makes them tick. And how do we foster that to be protected in the future? There's a significant pronghorn migration corridor north of Craters of the Moon, for example. Well, let's not mess that up in the coming years, because pronghorn will be looking to use their habitats in different times and maybe in different intensities, depending on how our climate changes. The eastern part of Idaho, sits right between, Yellowstone and these giant wilderness areas we have in the central part of the state. That's already been demonstrated as being a migration corridor for species like wolves, for example. If we think it's quite important to keep Yellowstone and central Idaho connected for wildlife use, however they see the need to be, whether it be black bears, whether it be cougars, whether it be pronghorn, mule deer. The idea that these corridors need to be identified, if you will, and foster that they maintain that character they have now that allows wildlife to use them.
It's hugely important, especially as the climate does change, the vegetation changes, predators' habitats change habits change as well. You look at with Yellowstone, grizzly bears are going into their torpor sleep later and they're waking up earlier. Predators tend to follow the prey migration, but they can also affect the migration. And, there's a thousand questions opening up as you protect these corridors.
Yeah, and it's going to be a very site-specific case. I mean, we can't say, you can't have a road across a corridor. Obviously, you have I-15, for example. Well, some animals are adapting to I-15. Can we make it better? Is that a place to consider a wildlife overpass, like they've used up in Canada to great effect to protect wildlife populations? We don't know yet, but that's got to be on the table to say, how do we foster and encourage and maintain the opportunity for wildlife to adapt to a changing climate?
Craig, as we wrap up here, I'd like you to give me a sense of what your sort of favorite part of a wilderness area is. Could you share a little bit sort of something that's near and dear to you that you've experienced in Idaho's wilderness?
First of all, it's very seasonally dependent. Hell's Canyon is wonderful in the spring, not so much fun in August.
Is it hot?
Craters of the Moon is wonderful in May, not so much in July. But I guess personally, one thing that I notice every time is the silence, the lack of background noise. And that's something that I have appreciated either almost every single time I've gone into a wilderness area. When you sit and have lunch, you sit over a promontory looking at a lake or someplace, not to quote Simon Garfunkel, but, you know, the sound of silence, if you will. The lack of noise, I think, is a real resource that's going to be more and more appreciated in our civilization, where you get back and you realize the utter stillness of a place where, you know, you can hear the wind in the trees a little bit, but otherwise, just the complete lack of background noise, the lack of intrusion of the sound of a motor or that mechanical sound, if you will. It just strikes me every time, and I can almost every time I visit a wilderness area, there's that opportunity for that experience to just sit for a bit or walk in silence for a bit and appreciate the fact that, wow, this is, I'm here, I'm alone, and it's a very peaceful experience.
And I totally agree with you. I've lived in Atlanta and Philadelphia, and it was such a refreshing moment to hear a meadowlark again. And all of a sudden, I froze, and you're like, that's a meadowlark. I haven't heard that animal sing in 10 years. And it's so nice.
A long time ago in Montana, one of the wilderness activists, when arguing for wilderness area, described the hush of the land as being something they wanted to protect. And I thought that's always been a pretty good capture of that character of a wilderness area, the hush of the land.
I love it. Well, to return to our trivia question that we started with, and how many acres of wilderness area are in Idaho? And how does that compare with other states? Could you help us with that question?
Well, Idaho has 4.8 million acres of wilderness. And that translates to about 9% of the total state area of the state. So we have 10%, less than 10% of Idaho per se is wilderness. 14% of public land is wilderness, though. Nationally, obviously, Alaska has more wilderness than we do. And in terms of raw acreage, California also. So Idaho comes in after that. We do like to make the point that Idaho has the largest contiguous wilderness area, the one large, which is the Frank Church River No Return Wilderness. It is the one at 2.3 million acres. It is the largest single block of designated wilderness in the lower 48.
Stand tall, Idaho.
You know, that's right.
Stand tall. Well, we want to thank Craig Yerke for joining us today. And to learn more about his work and the Wilderness Society, please visit wilderness.org.
The Nature of Idaho is produced at KISU-FM Studios at Idaho State University in Pocatello. Technical assistance and production by Jamin Anderson. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and all past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at KISU.org. Find The Nature of Idaho weekly podcast on iTunes or Google Play Music. For more information, click on the Idaho logo at KISU.org or send email to noidkisu@isu.edu.